And welcome once again to the Liberty Lounge. We're about to do the alliteration thing. We talk about firearms, faith, freedom, and fun. We're also talking a little bit about family today as well. All of the F words. We're joined today by Travis Brown. Y'all know him, UFC legend and all sorts of other things that he's doing today. We're excited about that. Up first is going to be Anthony. Y'all know him as the armed scholar. Anthony, what's your favorite thing about America today?
Freedom. More alliteration. Freedom. Yeah, I enjoyed you guys, listening to the last podcast, watching it. The response is getting better and better. We appreciate your guys' support. Of course, it's going to grow and we're going to gain momentum. And I know as we were talking on last podcast about some of the other topics, we mentioned that we have some fun interviews coming up and, you know, people outside of the firearms space, people within the firearms space. And as Johnny mentioned, we have Travis Brown here with us, famous, a lot of people watched him on the UFC. A lot of people follow him and his family, him and his wife. And it's an honor to be joined by you, Travis. I was telling the guys maybe like 2 months ago, something like that. I was just on Instagram and happened to check my, likes or whatever and saw that you had followed me. And I was like, that's not the Travis Brown, is it? And clicked the profile and sure enough, it was. So it's awesome that, you followed kind of what I was doing, follow me on Instagram. And it's an honor to have you on there. And we really appreciate you coming on and, having a conversation with the audience. So thank you. Thank you again for coming on. So yeah, of course, man. I think we just kind of want to jump into it, just start to have a conversation. Can you give, maybe audience members who don't know who you are, give a little bit of background about you, where you're born, a little bit of your upbringing, and then I guess we can transition a little bit into, your earlier career. And I know we got a lot of other things we want to talk about, but, sure. Just quick background on who you are.
Yeah. So my name is Travis Brown. I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii, raised there until just before maybe elementary school, and then moved here to mainland California, or as my cousin would call it, California Stan.
we'll get into that. I feel your pain.
Yeah. and then went to school here. I was a basketball player growing up. Unfortunately, school really wasn't for me. So in college, I did 1 year of college, played junior basketball for them. Just kind of stopped going because school wasn't for me. And I just kind of had that regret of not being an athlete, So fast forward until maybe like 9 years. So I was 27 when I started doing jiu-jitsu. And then started doing jiu-jitsu. It's like the gateway martial arts into MMA. And started getting punched in the face for a living. Did that for nearly 10 years. And been out of the octagon now for seven years. So, and been ranching.
Ranching, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll jump into that. Wanted to ask. Oh, go ahead, Jared.
Right. I was going to say, as somebody who is from the Boston area, like Dana, what is it like working for Dana White?
Dude, it's an amazing experience. He's an incredible inspiration to people that are around him, and if you don't see that from him, then there's something wrong with you. He is the American dream, right? Like look at what that guy is able to accomplish. Like, he is what people strive for. He took this company that was going broke. It was going under. Yep. I understand $1 million is a lot of money, right? He got investors. He did all this stuff. He put himself as the face of the company and he ran that thing until now it's worth billions and billions of dollars. So, and he sacrificed so much. When you want to talk about entrepreneurship and what it takes and the sacrifices it takes, family time, birthdays, holidays, all this kind of stuff to hang out with a bunch of dumbass fighters that probably don't give him enough credit. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because that guy's built an industry. He built MMA pretty much. When you really start looking at it, the UFC is the top of the mountain, right? Back in 2013, I was a free agent after I fought Josh Barnett. I could have gone anywhere and I could have gotten serious, serious money. Like I got offers for over $1 million a fight and all that kind of stuff. I stayed with the UFC because that's where the best of the best are. And I wasn't in it necessarily for a paycheck. I was in it to challenge myself and to be the best fighter I could be. So, and he created that environment. You know what now, I mean?
Speaking of the best, Travis, you have faced some scary, scary grown men. Now, we're on the outside looking in. Yeah. You're standing there in the middle of it with dripping, sweaty beasts coming at you. From the living room, from the comfort of my easy chair, you faced Arlovsky in the smack middle of Arlovsky, that tear that he did. And he was frightening. Travis, he was honest to goodness, at least from my couch, he was frightening. How was it standing across the ring? Was he as scary in person, at least as I felt from the safety of my home?
No, actually, me and him are buddies. So it was one of those things, you know, you want to talk about all these guys coming at you that are beasts and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not a little pussycat myself. You know what I'm saying? So you have to have that belief in yourself. So when you're looking across that cage, you can't be like, oh my gosh, this guy, he looks mean. He looks nasty. He's going to eat me up and all this kind of stuff. You go in there with an attitude of like, I'm going to mess this guy up. This guy doesn't know what's coming for him. He signed on the dotted line. He was wrong for doing that. He's the reason. So when I would go into a fight, those guys, my opponents would be the reason why I'd miss my kids' birthdays, why I'd miss Christmas, why I'd miss Thanksgiving, is because that son of a bitch across the cage for me is the one that signed all dotted line and he wants to test me. So that was the mentality that I had. You can't go into it thinking, oh, this guy's big, bad, and he's going to beat me up.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Arlovsky's a sissy, though, man. Honestly, I wouldn't say a sissy, but he's such a nice guy. He is such a nice guy that I'm like, he acts all tough, and you'll see if you guys ever see us together. I'm always calling him on his shit because he acts all tough, and I'm like, dude, come on, stop. You know, you love it. You like me. Come on, guy. And I'll give him a hug or something. He's like, stop it. Like, easy, my little Russian. He's like, I'm not Russian, I'm Belarusian. I'm like, oh, it's the same thing, dude. So, you know, me and him have that back and forth. So to me, he's not like a scary dude. You know what I mean? I stepped in there against a friend. I lost the fight. You know, I think there's a clip of it going around where he's like, man, I'm so sorry after the fight. And I was like, dude, don't you ever effing apologize, man. I was like, this is our job. This is what we're bred to do. This is what we're born to do. And so don't ever apologize. You were doing your job and I was doing mine. If I could have knocked you out, I would have. You know what I mean? And I didn't hold back. So I don't think people understand. Like, I don't need to hate you to punch you. You know what I mean? And that's the thing. And I guess we can get into it a little bit later on. But there's people out there, you know, there's a difference between somebody being harmless and somebody being peaceful, you know? And there's a big, big difference between the two. And, you know, I like to think of myself as a peaceful individual.
Yeah, which that's an interesting point, because I know us in the circles we've run, we have had the luxury of meeting some pretty well-known UFC fighters, Chuck Liddell, Junior Dos Santos, Josh Barnett. I've got to meet most of those guys and have pretty good. I mean, Dos Santos, I got to have probably a 2-hour long conversation with him at a bar, and same thing with Chuck Liddell. And even though they're the scariest people on planet who could probably destroy you, most of the times they're the nicest people, which is that you said, it's that interesting distinction between they're peaceful in the moment, but it doesn't mean they're, you know, pacifist or they can't do harm if they need to. I wanted to jump back to something you had mentioned earlier. You said, you know, you started doing jiu-jitsu at age 27 and that kind of springboarded you into, you know, doing MMA. Back when you were 27, you know, what time frame is that? Because, you know, depending on when that is, that's still early UFC. Did you think it would become what it is now and you would be where you are now? Because, you know, just even flashbacking 10, 15 years ago, the UFC definitely, it wasn't what it was now. Now it's scaling every single year.
Yeah. So I would say that I started doing jiu-jitsu maybe 22 or 2008. I had my first MMA fight 2009, And then I was signed by the UFC in 2010. So like at that time, I remember sitting on the couch watching Tim Sylvia against Rico Rodriguez and watching those guys and thinking that Rico was scary because of the ground game, and I didn't understand that. But as far as Tim Sylvia, I mean, he's a big dude. He was 6'8", 6'9", something like that. I mean, 265, and he had reach and everything, but he was not athletic. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, dude, like, I'm 6'7". I'm only an inch shorter than him. I'm a big dude. I'm a tough guy. I know I can fight. But at that time, I was just a street fighter, right? I was like, oh, I see red and, you know, whatever. one of those retards, you know what I mean? So it was like, dude, whatever. And so then I started thinking, like, you know, I bet you I could do that. And that was probably, I don't know, man, 2005, 2006, you know what I mean? And then my buddy kept, I was a basketball player, like I had mentioned before. My buddy, his name's Dustin. He would say, let me show you how to do an arm bar. And I'll be like, okay, whatever. And he'd like lay on his back and put his legs up. I'm like, what are you doing?
Get in my guard, like, bro.
Come here, get in my guard. And we're like on the basketball court. And I'm like, no, dude, I'm not going to do that. That's wrong. On so many, you know, this is early 2000s. So I'm like, no, bro. Like, I'm way too cool for that. So anyways, he finally talked me into it. We went to a jiu-jitsu place, and that's when it kind of turned into that. So at that time, if you would have asked me 2008, if I could see myself going that far, I just wanted to, like I had said, I was a basketball player, and then I wanted to continue being an athlete because I failed at school. And then I started working for myself and had a couple different companies, and it just wasn't fulfilling because I in my heart, I was an athlete. So I wanted to do something. And I, at that time, I started thinking about, you know, my kids, and I had both my kids at that point. So I wanted to show them that, I could get my black belt in jiu-jitsu. Right. That was like, I'm still going to be an athlete, but just in a different way. I'm going to go get my black belt. I'm going to try to get it as fast as I can, all that kind of stuff, and show them that no matter what, that you come from an athletic background and you can go and you can achieve these things. And where I was short and what I did, my shortcomings, you will succeed because you'll have me here to learn from, and I can kind of guide you in a different route that I took. Right. Which, well, again, was a schooling. So, yeah, just that's where it started, getting my black belt in jiu-jitsu. And then I was in the gym, and the guy showed up to spar somebody, and his sparring partner didn't show up. So they're like, you next, the biggest guy in the room, dummy, why don't you come over here and get punched in the face? I was like, okay, you know what I mean? Just this big oaf, you know, in there. And I ended up doing really well. You know, we sparred maybe four or five rounds or something like that. And I was gassed at the end, you know, because I didn't know what I was doing. But I held my ground. And the coaches then were like, hey, you got to give this a shot, MMA shot. And I was like, okay, sounds good. And then that's how it kind of started. I had two amateur Muay Thai fights, stand-up fights. I'd been doing some jiu-jitsu tournaments and putting it all together behind the scenes, and went out and had my first fight in Tijuana, Mexico. And, you know, sanitary was not up to par, but I'm disease free, you know, so I made it out.
Luckily didn't catch anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then the rest was history. A year later, I signed with the UFC. Three years after that, I was ranked third in the world. So, It was a fast, quick ride, a lot of work, a lot of sacrifices, but, you know, it was definitely worth it.
So you hear so often with elite athletes like yourself, like, the hardest decision is to know when to say when, right? When to walk away and to do the family thing. And maybe if you could, for the folks who are listening out there who followed your career, maybe give them a little bit of an insight. Like, when did you know when? And before that, I'll throw you a softball. Like, what was the fight that you hold as the top of your mountain for your career, like the best fight in your mind, regardless of result? Like, that was the one that made your career in your mind as far as satisfaction.
Yeah. So, I would have to say that the top fight that comes to mind for me, there's actually two of them back to back. It was in 2013. I had fought Alistair Overeem, and then I fought Josh Barnett. So back to back. August, I fought Alistair. At that point, that was the biggest fight of my career, right?
Great. Me too.
Yeah, thank you. Go out there and knock him out. First round, I got my butt kicked. I did. That dude has like heat-seeking knees and would hit me in the same spot with those damn knees over and over again. And so like the first one was like, okay, I felt that. Second one was like, okay, it's starting to do damage. Third one is like, oh, I can start feeling my stomach starting to hurt. Fourth one is like, okay, that took some wind out of me. The fifth one is like, okay, fine. Okay, stop. And then the sixth one, it was like, oh, can't breathe. And my body was shutting down. But it was in like the same spot every single time. And that was so amazing to me. It was ridiculous. And then he just, but anyways, I got up, knocked him out. A few months later, they call me up and they want me to fight Josh Barnett. And at that time I was like, dude, like, you know, hell yeah. This guy, Josh Barnett, is a freaking legend. He was the champ in the UFC back in the early days. He's a monster. You know, I would love to prove myself against him. He's actually a friend of mine now, and we talk, you know, time to time, and I actually go train with him still, stuff like that. But at the time, I didn't know him, right? We were strangers, and fought him. I had an amazing showing, knocked him out in like a minute. And that right there to me was like, man, I belong here, you know? And, after that, you know, my career kind of went up and down a little bit for a few years. Towards the end, and you asked me, when do you know? And, I would say I still don't know. Because I'm honestly still under contract. Oh, and cool. So it's one of those things where, at that time my kids were 9 and 10, and it was time for me to be home for them. And, I was talking with them, and, I asked them, I said, you know, boys, what do you think about me fighting and stuff like that? And they're like, Dad, we really miss you. You know, and I said, because I would leave. So I didn't have a normal situation where I'd live at home when I would be in fight camp. I would leave for 8 to 10 weeks at a time. So if I fought twice a year, I'd be gone for 4 or 5 months out of the year. If I fought 3 times a year, I'd be gone for 6, 7 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was taxing on my family. And so at that time, and I'm looking at them starting to grow and to be young men and seeing, you know, just the world at that time and the direction it was going. And I wanted to be home with my kids. That was part of it. I wanted to be home. They wanted me to be home. Am I going to continue? I'm coming off a 4-fight losing streak, right? Like my head's just not in it. It's time for me to step up and just be a dad, you know? And that was the decision I made. So again, when you ask, when do you know it's time? You don't. You know, I still feel like I want to get out there. I'm 41 years old, and I wouldn't put it past me to come out and have another couple fights and, you know, go out one way or another. But that's because my boys are now 16, 17 years old. I kind of got them over that hump. I could set up a situation here where I could still live here at the house and be here for them and train and do a full camp here and all that kind of stuff. My resources are a little bit better now. So it's like, man, do we give it a shot? Like what do you know, do I or do I not? So I don't know. I can't give you an answer.
And I say selfishly as a fan, yes, I would love to see that. I would watch that immediately. It's interesting for that.
I want to give you a quick shout out as a father of four, who my career, I was a cop for 24 years. It took me away. I missed all the birthdays. I missed everything you can imagine. And for you to put the family first, brother, congratulations. Not a lot of people do that. You'd made the right decision. So, you know, don't ever feel you didn't, because the fact that they had their parents there when they needed them the most in their life, it's only going to pay dividends. So good on you. But yeah, like Anthony said, we would all be right there, ready to go to watch the next fight.
Yeah, appreciate that, man. Sorry,
I cut you off. One of the things about your career that I find a little bit enigmatic, which I think is fantastic, I think you are one of the rare guys to be able to stand at your size, to be able to stand and to grapple as well. You've had multiple KOs of the night, but also submission of the night. And that's an interesting 1-2 package. I think your career, looking at it, I mean, in your mid-20s, you go from never having formally fought, you were a street fighter, to a pro in less than a year. At least that's what the press says about you. And I think that's fantastic. Those lessons that you learned, ground, standing, also on the business side, you're also having to be an entrepreneur and deal with your own career from a businessman and doing all the things like media and those kind of things you've done. As you've moved into this half of your life, what lessons have you learned from the ring that are helping you out now with what you're doing with charity and what you're doing with agriculture? How has that translated over to today?
People don't realize, but they watched me grow up in front of them, in front of the UFC. At the age of 27, you're still a kid, or at least I was, you know what I mean? And I had two young children, my own. I was still learning how to navigate life in general. And without my boys and without, I would say, the threat of getting your ass whooped in front of millions of people, that'll help straighten you up and have you dedicate yourself to a craft, right? Like, if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what is going to scare you. You know what I mean? Like we were talking about earlier, you're standing in front of this person who's been training, and usually almost for most of their life, to like kill you, right? That's another thing, right? But to train to beat you in this fight, to knock you out, to submit you, because I feel like what we do is still a sport. What these men and women do that protect our country, you know, first responders, stuff like that, that's the real life stuff. That's life or death. And so that's its own thing. That's something that, like, a lot of people in my industry don't understand. You know, we have a referee to make it a fair fight. We have rules, right? To make it a fair fight. The people that are out there don't have those same rules, right? It's a free for all. So that to me is more intimidating than what I do. What I do is like having a street fight at the end of school where you're sitting there and the bully comes up and says, "We're going to have a fight at 3:30. Under the willow tree after school," and you're sitting there like rocking back and forth in your seat all day in school when you're thinking about this fight. You see what I mean? There's a big difference. It's like you're stressed out because this guy said he's going to beat you up, but whatever, that's easy to deal with. The real life stuff is to me is more commendable, I would say. But yeah, I mean, I guess I took myself off track there. I apologize.
No, I love it. I love hearing that stuff. What is regenerative agriculture? Why does it matter? Why should we care? How did you get passionate about this? Tell us about it.
Yeah. So this whole thing came from, or Browsy Acres really came from, us wanting to be self-sustainable, not depending on anybody, like understanding that nobody is going to come and save us when shit hits the fan. We have a solar roof, right? We have water catchment. We have a garden. We have animals here that we can raise for meat. And that's where it kind of started. I'm an avid bow hunter. I absolutely love to get out in the mountains and go, spot and stalk and hang out. And a lot of times you're getting skunked, whatever. It means bow hunting. It's real hunting. You don't see something at 1,000 yards and shoot it, even though I think that's a skill set in its own as well. See something at 1,000 yards and shooting it. But I'm a bow hunter. So it all came from self-sustainability. We raised this animal. His name was Kobe. We harvested him. We're all emotional. Have our first bite. We're like, what is this? What is this? This is the best beef that we've ever had. And we raised it right here. Two and a half acres, right? Raised it here. Not necessarily on the best feed. Not regeneratively, like we've turned our ranch into, all that kind of stuff. Just like a normal household would. And we had the best bite of steak in our life. It's like, how could we do this? So called up the guy, had him bring down another calf. Him and I are talking. He's like, yeah, I'm going to try to scale this. It's costing a lot and da 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 da. And I have to sell a bunch of my calves to make up for the winter feed for the rest of my herd, all this kind of stuff. And so I'm like, well, do you want a partner and we can, you know, maybe get after this thing. Why don't we keep all the calves and sell them direct consumer? So that's going to be the highest markup value, you know, the highest form of profit. And then we can scale this thing even bigger than that, bigger than what you're looking at doing. My only ask is that I've been learning and I've been hearing about this regenerative agriculture and rotational grazing. And I, at that time, I didn't know what I was even talking about. I just kind of heard it, right? And said, like, this is what's right for the land. This is how animals are supposed to act, pretty much. If you think about like the big prairies and grasslands in the middle of the US where all the bison were and stuff like that, they would get pushed by wolves, by predators, all that kind of stuff, right? So they would stop by, eat some grass, they'd get pushed on to the next one. So that's what we do at our ranch up north, is we do this it's rotational grazing. So it's like mob grazing. They have an acre at a time, they mob it down, and then we move them to the next acre. So it's this process that mimics nature. It's actually going kind of reversing the clock, getting out of the commercial industry and all the corn and all the bad additives, right? We still feed a grain, but it's a diverse blend of grains that we feed. It's not a single, you know, corn that we feed only or something like that. And we also do a lot of things differently, like raise them out to 28 to 33 months. There's natural unsaturated fatty acids that develop as they get older and all that kind of stuff. And for people that don't know, that's the healthy kind of fat. It's a healthy animal fat that you want to take in. Has a lower melting point than your body, so it's not the kind that's going to get clogged up in your arteries and all that kind of good stuff. So this whole thing, just that's how it started. That's how Browsy Acres started. And I just fell in love with it. Like there, in my mind, at this point in my life, there's nothing better than riding my horse 6 o'clock in the morning out on a foggy morning through the pastures, gathering our cattle, bringing them in to do preg checks to, you know, we do AIs, we do embryo transplants. We do everything from conception to consumption. So that animal does not leave our ranch until it goes to harvest. That way we know every input that goes into that animal. And it's a sense of like owning and knowing where your food comes from, both from a what they're getting fed, but also how the animal is treated, right? These animals are allowed to be cows. You know, they're not stuffed into these little barns that are in these super small stalls and just force-fed stuff. You know, it's like our animals are happy. You know, we let them be cows, we let them be chickens, and that's our idea. And also, not only that, but it puts so many inputs back into the soil. It actually becomes a carbon sink. So, you know, all the climate change people talking about how cows and, you know, destroying the world and all that kind of stuff. It's like, shut up. It's not the animal, it's how they're raised. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know what to tell you. I could kind of go off about that one with climate change and vegans and stuff. Like I don't have a lot of patience. You know what I mean? I just, if you want to come have a discussion, we can have a discussion. But if you're going to say, you know, the stuff that most of them say, then I don't have any time for you. But yeah, the regenerative agriculture is the way to go. And our steaks, our meat, our product is really, it's because of that. It's because of how we raise them and the inputs we give them.
So I kind of want to take a quick step back. When you, because I've seen your guys' videos, I followed you guys a little bit on YouTube when you guys were first doing the thing at your home, you know, with your first steer and raising it and harvesting it. And I saw those videos and the emotions behind that.
Yeah.
But to step back even a little bit before that, was this your first, you know, kind of go around with animals? Did you grow up, you know, raising animals? Was that part of your life as it was? And then now you're just doing it, you know, with your family and your children. You know, how was that process?
Yeah. Neither my wife or myself came from a raising animal background, from a ranching or agricultural background. This is YouTube University. This is learning as you go. This is messing up so many times and getting so frustrated that, you know, you're ready to call it quits kind of a thing. But there's just something that tells you to keep going. This is like a passion of ours that's really come around. Like you said, we didn't know we had 2.5 acres. So we're like, hey, what can we do with 2.5 acres? Let's build a garden and get some chickens. I mean, chickens are, it always starts with freaking chickens, man. if your wife or girlfriend ever wants chickens, don't do it. Cause then you're going to have goats and horses and cows and garden and this, that, and the other, but that's how it always starts. Right. So, yeah, it just like, that's how we have 2.5 acres. Let's try to be self-sustainable. Let's try to raise our beef. We live in Southern California, Californistan, and it is not a great place to go hunt, right? Like I've lived here for a very long time. I don't think I've ever gone hunting here because I don't really enjoy being in California that much. If I have the chance, I'd rather go to Idaho. I'd rather go to New Mexico. I'd rather go to Oregon, Washington, Montana, Wyoming, you know, some of these amazing states. I'd rather go to Hawaii and hunt axis deer and hogs and stuff like that. I would rather spend my hunting time outside of California just, cause I've lived here so long, you know, and some of the other reasons I'm sure we can get into as well. But, so whenever, you know, not having that ability to go hunt here, cause there's not a lot of animals around, like you can't hunt an elk in Southern California or anything like that. It's like deer is the biggest animal. So wanted to raise our beef in case I couldn't get out and go hunting, raise a beef, have that self-sustainable, have protein in the freezer, be good to go. That's where it started. And then scaling it is really where, you know, where we're at now. And currently we're continuing to scale, and all the work, all the infrastructure that goes into having a regenerative ranch. Our ranch that we bought was traditionally used as like just normal grazing. They had like 3 different larger pastures. And when we got there, it was all mowed down. You could see a bunch of dirt through the grass, you know, didn't have heavy cover. It wasn't that great, you know? But now that we've had it for the last coming up on 4 years now, it's changed big time, and you can see a difference in the animals. We were grazing until early December this year, where normally people are pulling the animals off in October, November, because they don't have enough grass. You know, the first couple of years, that's what we were doing, pulling them off in October. We didn't have enough grass to hold them and had to put them in wintering areas and feed them hay. So just in the last few years, we were able to extend our grazing periods quite a bit.
I kind of want to go back to, you know, with, you said it always starts with chickens, and it's funny, especially even here in California, I have family members who traditionally, you know, we didn't grow up ranching or anything, but the area of California, I'm in Central California area. So there are a lot of dairies. There's a lot of ag around. And a lot of people are now random people, people who maybe are not of the political persuasion you would assume, are now moving to kind of self-sustaining. They're getting those chickens starting to, you know, dip their toes in that. Mm-hmm. And as our culture is developing in a very interesting way, our politics are developing in a very interesting way, you're seeing a lot of people moving towards prepping, self-sustaining. So, you know, from someone who kind of learned it as you went and learned from YouTube, what advice would you give someone if they're trying to be self-sufficient for the first time? You know, just start with chickens and learn as you go.
Definitely. Definitely start with chickens. Chickens are such a great source of food. They give you eggs, and then they can also give you meat, right? And that's where we started. And it doesn't take much to keep them. You know, you got to build an enclosure, give them food and water, but they'll start producing about 6 months after their chicks, you know, 6 months later, they start producing eggs. And also look into, you know, the type of chickens that you get and all that kind of stuff. And if you wanted to venture into meat, goats, or sheep, for, you know, lamb and stuff like that, those are also pretty easy keepers. Cattle, I would say, is probably one of the harder ones because you need a little bit more space, right? But man, it's so easy to be self-sufficient in these ways and build yourself a small garden, even if it's one little thing in the back on your patio and you're growing tomatoes. It's like, man, have pride with that. You'll taste the difference, and that's what will scare you and make you break up with your grocery store. When you start growing stuff for yourself and a tomato tastes like a freaking tomato, you know what I mean? Like, and it's like so much better. It's so much better. Same thing with our beef now that we raise, you know, that was the story of Kobe. Like, we raised this animal, he was fed a good diet, and he turned out amazing. It really gave us that inspiration. And one of the things that we also want to do with our platform and who my wife and I am, we want to make ranching, agriculture, getting your hands dirty, getting your pants dirty, we want to make that like cool again. People have lost that. Everybody, like, the number one thing people want to do is be an influencer, right? An influencer of what?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You don't want to be an influencer, people.
No, but you know what I mean? Not a social media influencer. Like, I want to influence. The only kind of influence I want to get is I want people to get outside more. I want them to get their hands dirty, put some soil in your hands, work with some animals, get on a horse, you know, go out, ride your ATV, like, be outside, be active. Don't be sedentary like these days and sit behind a TV or a phone or a computer all day long. It's like, get out and live your life. You only have this one life. There's so much out there to experience. And one of the things we want to do, and I'd start saying it earlier, is no better feeling than me on a horse when it's foggy going and gathering my cows in this beautiful pasture. And it's just like, you can breathe the clean air. You can feel it. You know, you're having an amazing time. It's a beautiful background. Where else would I rather be? You know, my family's with me. What? I want nothing more.
Travis, you mentioned Kobe, a cow that has been eaten at some point. Yeah. But is he still around? Is Kobe still around with us? Is he still around, or has he already been under the table?
Oh, he was our first one. He was our first one. The deal.
I am a lover, not a fighter. I am a softie. And I know you on some level are soft as well on the inside. You have feelings. Here's my challenge. 1 week ago, I bought 1 acre of land, and I have sat for the last week watching YouTube videos. I grew up, I mean, I've eaten what I've hunted. I've eaten what I've fished. I have sent animals to be with Jesus and then eaten them. However, a lot of the things I'm reading are saying to get meat rabbits. And so I've been watching about meat rabbits, and they're so fuzzy. And I'm like, once you give them a name, how am I supposed to send that to be with Jesus? And then when I get over to y'all's website, browseyacres.com, and read about what y'all are doing, Travis, we got to have a talk about this. You name them. You put them on YouTube. Yeah. And then you eat them. Brother, how do you do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're not named like Carl or Steve or something. You know, they're usually named after after a cut of beef. It's like, hey, go get Porter out of the fridge, you know. Go get a couple New Yorks from Porter. Go get a couple of ground from Kobe. Go get, you know, a steak from Bavette or whatever. It's easier to do it when you do it like that. You know what I mean? It really is. Then, you know, then what'll have to happen, I'll be like, hey, go get a couple pounds of ground, you know, from that one guy that we harvested from number 37. And then the kids are gonna be like, well, I don't, where's that one at? Or da, 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 da. And that's like, oh, it's in the right side of the third freezer on the left. And you know what I mean? It's like, it's easier just to give them a name, especially when you, like, we have a calf right now named Brisket, another one named Chucky for like Chuck, you know, for like Chuck roast or whatever. It's just a big front shoulder. So yeah,
I can't do it, Travis, and I don't know how you do it. Although anybody that visits your website, they're going to be able to see these sad animals that they're beautiful, but my Lord in heaven, I have no problem with subduing the earth and harvesting what the Lord has given us. But once you give it a name, it's all fuzzy. Jared, where are you at with the fuzzy animals?
I've never been part of. I've always been told don't name them. And when I first started watching y'all's YouTube years ago, and I remember the story of the first one, and I was like, well, he named it, there's no way, maybe it's just gonna be the, you know, like the kids are gonna be experiencing this one. And then
the kids are gonna be experiencing therapy. That's what they're gonna be experiencing.
But it works. So are you gonna be naming your rabbits, your meat rabbits?
Nope. No names. Number 12. We're eating number 12 tonight.
There you go. Give them numbers. That's all right, too. I mean, you know, that was my compromise to my wife, who was giving them all names. And I was like, babe, we can't do that. Like, you know, our cows, right? Our cows are females that have calves and stuff like that. We'll name them because they're not going to, we don't really eat those. You know what I mean? But I was like, babe, anything that we're going to eat, I said, has to have like some kind of food name to it. You know what I mean? Call it sausage, call it whatever you want to call it, gumbo, call it something, right? But we're going to eat it because, and we have to get a food name. So that was my compromise.
Travis, I have a rule in my life that if I see Wagyu on a menu, I order it. I don't care. I don't look at the price. I order it because it's kind of hard to come by, at least here in East Tennessee. You guys raise it and y'all send it out all over the place. Give me as a consumer a little bit of advice on Wagyu. What's good? Is it good? What should I look for? Make me better as a meat eater.
Yeah, so right now, Wagyu in general, if it's labeled Wagyu, it's going to be a mix. Okay. Ours is either full blood Wagyu, which is 100% Japanese genetics. It's the top of the line. It's like the real Japanese Wagyu. And then we call ours American Wagyu. So it's Angus Wagyu mix, 50-50. So anybody, if you want the American Wagyu or that mix, buy something that says Wagyu, or I like to, and that's a whole nother conversation, is the labeling here in the United States is such a cluster. So we try to be as transparent as possible and try to educate people about what we're selling and the difference that we're doing, right? There's other people that buy their stuff and they're like a third party vendor. And so they don't know how their animals were raised and all that stuff. So what I would suggest going and looking up a ranch that you feel comfortable with, that does everything from A to Z, from conception to consumption, because they're going to know how the animal was treated, what it was fed. And I have more interest in having that animal live the best life it can than anybody else does, because I'm the one paying for it, right? So that's what I would suggest doing. Looking up a ranch, depending on what kind of beef you want, whatever, chicken, beef, have them do from start to finish. That is the best route. That's where you're going to get the most bang for your buck, and you're supporting small ranches, small farms, all that kind of good stuff. People got to break up with the grocery store. I've said that a couple of times already, but it really needs to happen.
All right. So a lot of our viewers and listeners are in the firearms community. So let's breach that because you are a brother. What got you into the firearms community? And tell us, most of us know, but what's it like being a firearms enthusiast living behind the communist wall? I'm from originally, so I get it.
Yeah. So, I actually was not allowed to own a firearm until 2015. I had a naked felony on my record from when I was 19, and I got it taken down to a misdemeanor and then expunged. And so now, you know, and it started off very slowly, actually, is getting back into it because I wasn't very familiar. You know, 2015, I'm in the middle, or might have been 2012 or something like that, actually. But I'm like kind of in the middle of my career, right? So I'm super focused on fighting. And when I'm saying that fighting takes all of your attention, I mean, you know, it really does. So it took a little bit for me to really get into firearms. But since then, it's like, for me, it all comes down to keeping my family safe. You know, like I have a couple of, you know, rifles, we have a couple of long range weapons, stuff like that. But for me, it's mostly, you know, how do I keep my family safe and those firearms that can do so. And that's where I'm a real enthusiast. Like if you ask me about all these different firearms, I'm going to look at you like you're speaking Japanese. But if we're, you know, when we start talking about, you know, protection of the family and what it takes and what I'm comfortable shooting and stuff like that, oh man, let's talk, you know what I mean? Because that's what I'm all about. And it's unfortunate now that a lot of the government these days don't want to allow that. They want you to depend on the police department when they're not going to come and save you. Like in that moment, they're not there. They're not hiding in your closet. Right. If you're out with your family and your kids at a park, like who's going to come save you? Nobody. Then that's such a, like it was like a light bulb that went off in my head one time years ago. This older gentleman was like, you know, if a bank robber walked into a bank and there were 30 people in that bank, and he let off a couple rounds into the ceiling and said, hey, there's a bank robbery. And as soon as he looked forward, there were 15 people holding guns pointed at him. What would happen? Mm-hmm. Right? Those 15 people weren't there to rob the bank. So why is it bad for them to have a firearm?
Yeah.
Right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. They're there just like me. You know, just that's how I look at myself. Like I could be anywhere. People talk about sensitive areas and whatever. That's kind of weird. But like in my mind, if you know, like if I'm at my kid's school, right? That's where I want to carry because the bad guys are going to be like, that's a gun-free zone. Nobody's going to be there with a gun. So that's where I'm going to go shoot. You know, that's where I'm going to go take care of some whatever. Do you see what I mean? It's like, it's so dumb and backwards, but for me, I really got into it so I could protect myself and my family. Mostly my family, because I know for me that I can take care of myself, right? When it comes down to stuff. But now that I've had the career that I've had, my wife's had the career that she's had, people aren't coming to us to start a fist fight. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
they're gonna get
that's a poor mistake. That's
poor. Yeah,
somebody right? Doesn't know anything about anything.
Yeah, they're not gonna come start a fist fight. So, where does that leave us, right? Somebody's gonna come with a gun or a knife,
right?
At the very least, a knife. I need to protect my family. That person is not gonna get through me to get to my family, and that's the way I look at it. And that's what got me so passionate about firearms, about the Second Amendment. Watching Anthony and Arm Scholar, my cousin Claude Abusaif, he's the one that turned me on to you. He's, you know, he's a, he would Yeah, shout out to Claude. Yeah, he would seriously send me, like, I can go through my text, but video after video, he's like, "You're so stoked." He's like, "Freaking California stands going down." You know what I mean? And all this kind of stuff. He's sending me your videos and all this kind of stuff. And then at first, honestly, I was like, "Oh, cool, cool, cool." And then I started watching them. And what I really appreciate that you do is you break it down for dummies like me to understand. Right. And I'm not a stupid person. I'm just, it's hard for me to really understand the legal side of all the different court systems. And you're like, you know, just talking about this judge and there's a 9-person panel and da 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 da, and breaking it down. And that, like, helps me understand, like, dude, this government's really screwed up. Like, how about we do less government?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, and let people be responsible for themselves. You know what I mean? That's kind of my stance, right? Is like, less government, less overall control. Let us take care of ourselves. Everybody should be responsible for themselves and be a good person. And the bad people, they get dealt with, right? They go to jail. They end up on the wrong side of whatever, you know? It's like, stop letting these guys go free. Stop giving them
California, yeah. As you know, I mean, I'm in California, I'm in Central, you're in Southern California. You're probably in a worse area than me, but it's even bleeding into my area. I mean, the homelessness, the crime rates, and then at the same time, we're dealing with all the politics here.
Yeah.
Even with firearms not wanting us to carry in certain areas.
Yeah. And
obviously, you're more exposed than me. I mean, I have a little bit of exposure, I guess, as far as an influencer, but obviously you and your wife, a higher profile, and you know, you're being told by the state of California that you guys can't take additional means to protect yourself, which is ridiculous. I wanted to springboard off of something because I know a lot of our audience are heavy firearms guys, but talking to someone like you who has a heavy martial arts background, you fought in the MMA, you fought in the UFC, you said you're a black belt in jiu-jitsu. Actually, I have a quick question. How fast did you get your black belt? Because you said you were trying to get it as fast as possible.
So I actually never got my black belt. The highest I got was a purple belt, but that's because I stopped training with a gi. So I stopped training with the gi when I started fighting, right?
Yeah.
So I trained for, you know, I mean, I'm people in the jiu-jitsu community might get upset, whatever. Listen, I've gone how many rounds? Like 8 rounds with Fabricio Verdum. He got me down. I was able to get out. He didn't tap me. Get out of here, dude. He's one of the best black belts out there, right? I went with Josh Barnett. I fought these different guys in MMA. I understand it wasn't a grappling match, but that's like the ultimate test, right? I've submitted guys that are black belts. So people can consider me whatever they want. I don't really care, but I'll tell people I'm a purple belt because that was the last belt that I received. So
yeah, and it's probably a little bit too much like shop talk, because I train jiu-jitsu as well, and I kind of want to springboard off of another question. I'm only a lowly blue belt, but especially in the new age, there's those camps between gi guys, and you have to go up the ranks, you have to also train in gi, and then you have like the new wave guys, literally new wave guys, John Donaher and all them that, you know, Gordon Ryan, who only do no gi, and they can get black belts just training no gi. But, you know, you talk 10 years ago, that was kind of obscure. It didn't really happen. But for firearms guys who rely all exclusively on firearms, what would you recommend for them if they don't want to always resort to lethal force? What do you recommend them as far as training martial arts? Do you say like, hey, you need to also have some sort of combative training?
100%. I think you need to have a good skill set, especially in close quarters, right? I would say the number one thing would be to wrestle, like even grown men, right? Not necessarily jiu-jitsu. I'm saying to go and start wrestling. And the reason I say that is because wrestling teaches you aggressive, like how to be aggressive. Right? Somebody's in your space, you're not going to want to sit there and pull guard, right? You're going to want to take them down, get them in a hold. One of my close friends, Phil Davis, he fought for the UFC. He I think he was champion Bellator. He's
Penn State, like, right?
Yeah, Penn State, yeah,
national champion.
That guy used to roll me up like a freaking pretzel, dude. And he would be able to control me with one leg and one hand because he knew where to put the pressure and where to hold. Right. And I would literally be wrapped up like, all right, Phil, you know, he's like, dude, you got to get out. This isn't a submission. I'm just holding you. And I would have to get out. Right. And he would just frustrate the hell out of me. But wrestling first, it teaches you a sense of control. It teaches you how to stay on top, how to get on top and how to stay on top. You never want your back on the ground, right? Especially if you have a firearm, you don't want to be in that position. Then I would move to a submission style martial arts. That way, if you didn't want to be lethal, you could literally rip somebody's shoulder out and or tear up their ankle or both ankles so they couldn't run away, kind of a thing, right? It's like there's or you could just hold them until the cops got there, or whatever you really wanted to do. But I would say wrestling first teaches that ability to take somebody down and be on top and stay on top, and then a submission.
With that said, how do you manage, without giving away obviously any plans you have with the family, how do you and your wife manage that demand for the public spotlight where you go and most people know who you and she are? And how do you carry yourself in public being somebody who's famous and having a wife who's also famous and wanting to care for them as a protector?
Always knowing my next move. It's super important. It's knowing where you are, knowing your surrounding, and always knowing your next move. Because then you can't be trapped. And you got to keep your eyes open. You got to be aware. My wife, like, that's the good thing about me and my wife, right? When I'm around my wife, I'm not famous at all. People, like, they don't even realize it's me. You know what I mean? The, like, oh my gosh, Rhonda, da 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 da. And then they, like, look to the side and they see my chest and they look up like, oh my gosh, and Travis Brown? I'm like, oh yeah, I'm also here. I'm her, you know.
I'm a person.
Yeah, I am a person, yeah. So it's like, so I get to always watch what's going on and see, you know, any threats or whatever. Like, there have been a couple of times we were traveling, all that stuff. People get excited. I understand all that. There have been a couple of times where somebody's run up behind our security, and because I already saw it coming, they would get like two or three steps from the back shoulder of my wife coming up to the back, and I would put a hand in their chest and I'd be like, dude, you got to stop. You know what I mean? And they're like, oh my gosh. And they, you know, now I kind of look like I'm, you know, being a little bit extra, but I don't care because this is my wife. This is my family. You know, these are my kids. And so it's like, I'm there to protect them. But yeah, being vigilant. I think one of the things that I really want to go do is train with Tim Kennedy, Sheepdog Response. I think what they're doing is amazing. I think they're really helping people, giving them the tools to be successful in those situations, to always be aware. You have to plan. You have to understand what you're getting yourself into.
For more information on Browsy Acres, y'all can check them out at browsyacres.com. I Googled it. It popped right up. So if you don't know how to spell Browsy, I bet you can figure it out. This is the Liberty Lounge, where we talk about all the F words: firearms, fun, freedom, faith, family, and today is fighting. We've been joined with Travis Brown, from BJJ to Muay Thai, Bellator, UFC. He's punched pride guys in the side of the head, and now he's a cowboy baby. Travis Brown, what is next for you and Rhonda?
Man, we're here, and we're just going to continue ranching for right now. We're going to build our family, and we're going to continue ranching. That's the...
I absolutely love it. Sustainability, regenerative agriculture, and taking not just our own self-protection, but also our own self-sustainability into our own hands. I love it. Jared, final word. Jared of Guns and Gadgets, what's your favorite thing about America, and final word for today?
favorite thing about America is we're free, and we get to defend ourselves and defend this country if ever it comes down to it. I just want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule. Being a family guy myself, I get it, especially when you're running a ranch. You work more hours than most people do. So thank you very much for your time, man. And it's been a pleasure to watch your career. And you have to let us know. I mean, maybe not the first to know, but if you ever decide to get back in that octagon, let us know, man.
You got it.
That was Jared with Guns of Gadgets with the final word. The first word was, of course, Anthony, the Arms Scholar. I'm Johnny B. from the YouTube. This is the Liberty Lounge, and we'll see you soon.